sampled it from him, but it's not the same bass line.
You can get in serious trouble for copyright infringement.
You got an organ going.
Yeah? Copyright is not doing crap!
Copyright? What's copyright?
It's the right of the
owners
to control.
Right?
No. You know what time it is.
Welcome to
the copyright
experiment. Welcome to the copyright experiment. It's 11 o'clock on a Thursday night. Well, no, it's not 11 o'clock, actually. Sorry about the delay. There's some studio construction and cleaning going on these days at the station. And we had some delay getting in here. But still going to put on a good show. And my name is Autonomy. I'm here with DJ Mochi.
Yo.
And today we are finishing off our series, our
four-part series
on copyright versus other copyright music versus copyright in other industries. And the first one we did was
film.
No, it was software, film. Last week we talked about academic disciplines and science, and today we're talking about book publishing. The original copyright, you could think of it as. And we're also going to talk a bit about FunDrive, which is partly why all this construction and stuff is happening in the studio. FunDrive is the annual fundraiser for CITR, and it's happening next week. So on our show next week, we're going to be talking about FunDrive and trying to get you, our dear listeners, to donate money to our dear station and support independent radio and shows like ours.
And most importantly, supporting our station's move to the new Student Union building, which is going to be amazing.
It's going to be great, but it is going to cost money because installing a radio station in a new building is not a easy thing to do.
As I'm sure you can imagine. Yeah.
If you ever seen a picture of the radio station here, it's a pretty impressive little setup. And we're going to be moving all that into the new sub. And when you're moving, it's always good to have some friends help you out. And so that's the theme of this year's Fun Drive: friends help friends move. And I hope you'll be our friend and help us move into the new sub and help us create an awesome studio there. Anyway, moving on.
We'll talk more about this next week, of course.
Yes. And actually, do you have the link we could
give people? We have a link already up if you want to donate online. It's bit.ly/TCE Fun Drive. So that's T as in the, C as in copyright, E as in experiment, TCE Fun Drive. And you can donate there anytime up until basically the end of Fun Drive, which is Thursday, March.
Oh, yeah, March 5th.
March 5th, yeah. And you can also call into our show next week. We'll also be coming around with forms to harass you if you are one of our dear friends.
Yep. We're also going to have some prizes.
Yeah, we're thinking about some parties.
There's going to be some station prizes. So, and it's really cool swag, actually. You can get, for $60, you can get Rad Socks. Rad Socks. CITR used to be called Rad Sock, so they made these cool Rad Socks with the old CITR logo, and they're really snazzy. I saw them today. You look really slick with them, especially if you cycle and you tuck your jeans into them.
Oh, yeah.
So there's lots of really cool prizes. There's t-shirts and hoodies and stuff. If you donate, can show off that you're a friend of CITR.
Yeah. And then we'll have our own prizes on the show.
Yeah.
If you are so financially benevolent upon us.
Yeah. And you'll be able to employ our services.
Yes, one way or another.
Yeah. We leave that up to you. So today we're going to talk about the publishing industry. We'll talk more about FunDrive later. The publishing industry is interesting when it comes to copyright because it was the original reason that copyright existed. So back in the early 1700s, when the printing press had kind of proliferated throughout Europe, there became this need to, or this desire anyway. I don't know if it was, it's debatable whether it was a need, but it was desirable for publishers to protect the authors that they were publishing. And it was that was kind of how it was framed at the time, as the publishers that really wanted copyright so that authors could avoid having their work infringed upon or twist their words or published without permission. And this was kind of a problem because rogue publishers were popping up a lot, and there was no, in an early day of like when a new medium comes around as influential as the printing press was, there's kind of a mad rush, and it's kind of a crazy place where anything can happen and people do whatever they want because there's no rules. And
internet.
Exactly like the internet. So that's how it was for book publishing, and people were just publishing whatever. They were taking people's words and changing them. And this is right around the time also that because of the advances in publishing, in that you could one person could write a book and a million other people could read it. It kind of formed this idea of what an author is, which didn't really exist before the printing press. The people that wrote books were kind of just they wrote manuscripts and communicated directly to people, and were kind of talking about topics, but didn't really think of themselves as authors or people, you know, proliferating information to others. And yeah. So that's the reason why, you know, the idea of intellectual property didn't even really exist then in writing, because nobody really thought that they were an author proper.
Yeah, now for the first time you have people, you know, feeling like the sole creators of a work, you know, mm-hmm. feeling like they sort of were the originators and therefore deserve some kind of a intellectual respect for that.
Yeah, and like I said, this was largely driven by the publishers and the stationers who really wanted to standardize book publishing as a business. So you can kind of see right away that copyright was, it's created in order to protect artists' rights, but it was initially created, and it still exists, to protect the business of book publishing. Fast forward a bit later, and if we go across to the other side of the Atlantic Ocean, across the pond, the United States was starting to become a serious economic power in the early 1800s. And because the United States was a fairly new country and publishing was a fairly new medium, it was kind of also an even crazier free-for-all over there. And what ended up happening is that a lot of the books that were published in Europe, mostly in Britain and France, they were taking over. Most of the British books or translated French books were being taken over to the U.S. and then copied without permission and distributed, and publishers were basically just stealing. I shouldn't say stealing. They were taking other people's books and just republishing themselves. And these were, they called people that did this even back then pirates. And that was kind of one of the earlier uses of piracy as not referring to the seafaring type. So a lot of people got upset about that. And the reason that they were able to do that in the U.S. was because non-citizens didn't have any copyrights in the U.S. until 1891. So that meant anyone who wrote something not in the U.S., they could publish whatever they wanted and take someone else's work and publish it too.
And not to mention that if you publish something that people don't know, which I can imagine a lot of people aren't going to know, you know, works from around the world. So if you publish something that people don't know, and they don't know it's not your original work, then how are you going to get in trouble? You know,
right,
it's,
yeah.
It's a lot easier to get away with, whereas nowadays, you know, okay, the internet's there. Everyone can have access to it, you know, and check it against all kinds of other sources and whatnot.
Yeah, although the thing with the internet is that it moves so fast that it's often, you know, by the time you often check out the paper trail for it, then it's already become irrelevant.
It's true. But, I mean to say that a major work back then that was big in another country but not big in the U.S. could be more easily copyrighted than nowadays.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
It's because the dissemination of information is so different now.
Mm-hmm. So one of the big critics of this U.S. style of book publishing was actually Charles Dickens, who later in his life traveled to the U.S. and tried to lecture the Americans on the virtues of copyright and tell them to stop stealing his work. And it didn't really go over so well. The Americans, they kind of liked the way things were going. And as you can imagine, them having kind of a burgeoning economy based partly on newsprint and book publishing, they kind of wanted to keep it that way. And so he didn't really change too many minds. And I think it ended up contributing to his a decline in health later in his career. But that weighed heavy on him. But you can kind of, it's funny, you can kind of think of the book publishing industry in early United States history as similar to the movie publishing, the rogue movie publishing industry in Asian markets, where you can get Hollywood movies for dirt cheap that are pirated and often transcoded and multiple films on the same disc and everything. And it's pretty much the exact same thing that's happening. And ironically, the U.S., which were on the production end of that initially, are now on the rights protecting end of it this time.
Yeah, when we say a lot cheaper, we're talking like a few dollars for like a big movie or like a
right.
like a set of movies, you know.
And often movies that aren't even released in that country yet.
Yeah.
But then after copyright reforms kind of came into the United States, the book publishing industry, I mean, the fact that they were allowed to publish pirated books allowed them to create huge amounts of like profit margins for their industry, and it kind of created a really robust publishing industry in the U.S. And copyright reform came, but by that time the publishers were already pretty powerful, and in their early 20th century they actually strengthened that by kind of a clever PR move where they're trying to get people to own books rather than just read them, because the prevailing way of reading at the time was for someone to buy a book and then they would just give it to someone after they finished reading it, because why do you need to hold on to the book? You already read it. But the publishers wanted to sell individual copies to books, which again, this is very reminiscent of the way that digital culture is now, where yeah. people want you to buy, each one of you has to buy your own copy. And they wanted people to buy their own copies and keep them so that they could sell more copies. And so the way they did this was by, during the construction boom across the U.S. in early 20th century, they gave incentives for home builders to build bookshelves directly into the house. And so it created this empty bookshelf in these homes that people were buying, which on its own, by itself, basically created an incentive for people to actually buy books and fill their bookshelf and show it off to their friends and kind of create a culture of, book possession rather than just book consumption.
Yeah, if that doesn't scare you a little bit, it scares me a little bit, you know.
That you can actually do that?
Well, yeah, not that you can, but just that, corporations are sneaky that way.
You're right.
I don't think that's changed too much.
So no, it hasn't.
There's other ways that I imagine they do that in our own digital age.
Yeah, definitely. So we'll kind of flash forward again to the 21st century, where we've now seen another revolution in the book publishing, which is online publishing, and particularly ebook publishing. So in the kind of early 2000s, that's when ebook readers started coming out. I can't remember the exact time when like the Kindle came out, but ebook readers started to become popular later in the 2000s.
Yeah.
And now they're very popular. And everyone either has a tablet or an ebook reader that I know. And it's created a thriving ebook publishing culture. And because now the barrier, just like music, is so low to publish music, you can just write your book and put it up on Amazon's ebook store and immediately start making money off of it. Boom. It's created this thriving industry of people who buy ebooks. And the funny thing about ebooks that hasn't really changed so much in music to a certain extent is that ebooks, because they're not limited to an investment in the book initially, they can be as long or as short as they need to be. So you see a lot of people publishing short stories like on their own in ebook stores, which is interesting. One of the most fascinating things to come out of the online ebook craze, I should say actually though, that in 2008 was the first time that ebooks actually outsold regular physical books. And so that's kind of a landmark time where people really shifted over to ebooks and really embraced it. And as of 2009, 76% of all the books released were ebooks. And part of that is because ebooks are shorter and smaller. You can sell like you can just write a book in a month and sell it on there instead of having to have it vetted and edited and create like a 200-page piece for sale. But it's definitely because the barrier to entry is a lot lower now as well. It's probably the main reason. One of the most interesting things to come out of this low barrier of entry and kind of creating a more democratic state of authorship was the rise of erotic literature, which became very popular, especially on Amazon. And they kind of turned a blind eye to it for a while. And recently they started controlling it a bit more because in some people's opinions, it was starting to get out of hand. And
no pun intended.
Most, yeah. Yes, yeah. It was probably the most bizarre example of it was, and this really showed how weird it was and also how lucrative it was as well. There's this author named, what's her name? Virginia Wade, who was making, at the peak of her book sales, $30,000 per month off these book sales of her cryptozoological erotica entitled Come for Bigfoot. So and I believe you can still buy it, but Amazon has kind of tightened up the controls for it, so I think she had to rename it. But
and for those who don't know, cryptozoological,
yes,
erotica is zoological, so that's animals, and then crypto is animals which may or may not exist, yeah. Like Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster.
Mythological monsters. Yeah. A Pegasus or something.
Yeah, and then erotica is obviously erotica. Mm-hmm. And so you combine all that and you get Come for Bigfoot and
yes.
Whatever else, I don't know.
It's a great equation you got there.
Reach around for a snowman or something.
Reach around for a snowman. Yeah, so this industry really took off, which is surprising, but at the same time, it's kind of... it's nice to see, I think, which I don't know if many people would agree with, but just the fact that a genre that would normally be ignored by a publisher is getting exposure and doing well because people actually want to read it is really cool. It's really empowering to book readers, I think.
Yeah, I think that's great because it distills it down to the essence of what people want to consume,
mm-hmm.
not what the producers think we want to consume,
right.
Which sometimes becomes we want to consume, but at least in this case, we have basically no middleman telling us or directing us. Yeah,
the kind of the gates that filtered out what was viable is no longer there.
Yeah, or at least very less, much less, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, a lot of this actually erotica hit the mainstream too when Fifty Shades of Grey, which started off as a self-published fan fiction, became picked up by a publisher. So, and we've seen this in music too, where someone will put out something online and they'll get a big fan base and they'll sign a major label contract 6 months later. That actually happened to A$AP Rocky, who put out most of his mixtapes for free, and now he's on a major label.
Yeah, I've definitely seen, like, I've been watching this one artist, Wave Razor, who... he started off releasing his stuff for free, and then a few months later, it's no longer free. And then a few months later, he's on a label. And then a few months later, now he's doing his first record with some other guys. And you know, it's amazing. It all starts, you know, just one hit on the internet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is, you know, partly why we are so strong advocates of, you know, this free music paradigm, because it really does it. If it does, not everybody's going to get a record deal, but, you know, it does open up a lot of doors. And the most important thing is that it allows you to put your stuff out there if you want to, which is very empowering, I think.
Yeah, and like we said many times, the biggest thing is just that reduction of the barrier between an artist's desire to make something and then actually getting it out there.
Right.
I mean, that's huge. And people complain about the loss of book sales, and there has been a downfall of book sales. When did that start, Tim?
The decline in... Well, this is physical bookstore sales declined. So going into the bookstore and buying books, this has declined since 2002 or so.
Yeah.
Which is when ebook readers started coming out. But, I mean, that doesn't tell you the whole story, because it also... people are also buying physical books online, too. Yeah. But, yeah, the decline of the bookstore is certainly a fact that we've seen, and we've seen lots of bookstores close down, and when they don't close down, they get they combine with another one to kind of reduce their competition costs.
And I think one of the biggest takeaway messages from this is that in order to be successful in this industry, you kind of have to embrace the new model, you know, and give people what's convenient, what's cheaper. And in this case, ebooks are both more convenient and cheaper, and they allow for a wider range of content to be available.
Right. And, you know, yeah, it's paying off for even the publishers as well, because they take a cut from the ebook sales. So, I mean, it's really, you know, the publishers initially jumped on to the trend at the time when by fairly dubious practices of copying books from the Europe, but you know, now they have to adapt again, and some of them are and a lot of the publishers have actually banded together as well and started buying each other up, and which is kind of reminiscent of the major label trend in music, of bigger labels buying smaller labels and combining. So we have like the big five now in the music industry, and now there's also a big five in the publishing industry as well.
It's a big five or big six?
Well, there are six kind of publishing groups, but those include like newspapers.
Okay.
There are five big major book publishers, though. Yeah, that kind of puts a nice end to our comparison of book publishing and music. Anything else you want to add?
I think that's everything. We're going to be right back. You're listening to CITR 101.9. This is the Copyright Experiment. Be sure, we're going to remind you again, next week is Fun Drive. So
next week is Fun Drive.
Get your monies ready. Get your friendship ready to help us move.
Yeah, if you want to donate, you can donate by check by mail, cash in the station, credit card online, or by phone. So yeah, you got no excuses for not having a method of payment. But and also, if you want to support the station throughout the year, there's also a direct deposit and monthly payment option.
There's all kinds of things. Anyways, we're going to go to some ads, and we'll be right back with the mix.
Stay tuned.
Oh my, become a friend of CITR and get great discounts downtown at
The Baker and the Chef, Bangone T-Shirts, Cherry Bomb, House of Vintage, Beat Street Records, Dunleavy Snack Bar, The Fall Tattooing, Fortune Sound Club, Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Perch, The Portside Pub, Save on Meats, Vinyl Records, and Zoo Shop.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus, or go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining. That's what friends are for.
If you are 65 years of age or older, you may be eligible to participate in a free exercise program offered at the YMCA in Surrey, Langara, and downtown Vancouver as part of a research study being conducted by the University of British Columbia. In this program, you are invited to attend exercise classes offered 3 days per week for 3 months. If you are interested, call Dr. Samantha Harden at 604-822-9140. Again, the number is 604-822-9140. More information at gold.kin.educ.ubc.ca.
Yeah, hey, welcome back. Here's a thing to CITR, the Copyright Experiment. TJ Mochi's going to get into the mix soon. I'm going to keep reminding you about FunDrive. Is that URL again? Bit.ly, so bit.ly/TCE FunDrive. TCE FunDrive. We'll post it on our blog too. If you want to hear previous shows, stuff like that, the blog is the place to do it too. And if you hear any tracks you like, you can download them for free on our blog.
What?
A great service, definitely worth donating for.
We'll be right back.
aqui o bagulho é doido, hein?
Vibes. This is Dream Fabric by Shagabond. Where that was this track called Bagulho Doido by Omulon Comrade. We'll be right back. That's a new track from Sobota out of Vancouver. Bobby Slade and Max Ulis. Single off their upcoming LP called Jeans. You can get it for free on Accelerator. A cool track by Odessa from Seattle, featuring Alan Grant. We'll be right back. Get a Little Ghetto, Boss Ass Bitch by P-Tap. That's pretty taking all the fades. Recently signed due to a collab on this track with Nicki Minaj, remix of it. This is the bot edit, free from main course. Small Town DJ's latest single, get it free on Fool's Gold, called See Through, with Lisa Lobsinger from Broken Circles, and the remix by Astronema and Wookiee. Kelly remix, courtesy of Lee Carvello, off his Canadian Club EP.
Yeah, eat that pussy, kiss that pussy, eat that pussy like I own that pussy, get in that pussy.
And this is going to wrap it up for us for tonight. Pierre's in the studio. He's got oral tentacles coming up to take you through the rest of the night. Have a good one.